You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and I bring you conversations with technologists who spend time on call. This week, I bring you Sylvia Botrus, the DB Smasher. Sylvia is a principal engineer over at Twilio, and you know what? Sylvia is a really interesting person that I've noticed for years on Twitter, and I got really lucky. I asked if Sylvia would take part in an interview, and Sylvia jumped right at it, said yes, absolutely. It's always great to talk to people who come from, I guess, operations from different aspects of the role. And in this case, you know, Sylvia spent years and years working on databases, and that's why she's known as the DB Smasher, at DB Smasher on Twitter. So let's enjoy her interview, but before we do, it's been a cool couple weeks. I've gotten a lot of cool responses from the interviews lately, and I'd really like you to give me your voice, be part of one. To do that, it's real simple. Just get in touch with me by sending an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Send a Twitter message at oncallnightmare. If I haven't got back to you and you've reached out, it's only because of time. We got the holidays coming up, so I'm going to try to get in one more extra interview before the Thanksgiving holiday. I'm going out of town myself. I hope you all have a really cool holiday. So I'll try to get you something to listen to, but if I don't, you know, understand, it is the holiday season. So anyhow, let's get into our conversation with Sylvia on this week's On Call Nightmares. You're listening to On Call Nightmares, and I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call. So I get a chance to talk to all the most interesting people in technology, and once again, I found another one of them. It's Sylvia Botrus. She is a senior principal engineer over at Twilio. She focuses on ways to break databases, and that's why she is the DB Smasher, as you may know her on Twitter. Whether she's helped build it or not, she will help the people at Twilio SendGrid break things, figure out how to fix them, and send billions of emails a day, and trolling people over on Twitter as well. Hi, Sylvia. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that I've really tried to do is make sure that I've talked to people who come from lots of interesting places in technology, and I haven't talked to many DBAs, and you kind of have described yourself as an accidental DBA from your bio and some things that I've read about you, and from that I believe you've taken on responsibilities that are, you know, you've got to know things about the database that essentially people, or the database is, that other people don't necessarily know. So I really wanted to talk to somebody who came from that angle. So thank you very much for being part of it.
Thank you.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about you. So you get your start in your education in Egypt, and then you finish your education at California State Fullerton, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And you go from working, like, I guess, in school as a IT assistant, and then eventually move towards being a junior software engineer, and then eventually move into kind of a software slash DBA role at another company. So we're talking real early in your career, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I actually started becoming involved with the database long before it made it into my quote unquote title. So my first job out of college was in New York in a now long gone CDN. Fun fact, that CDN was actually sister company to Tengen, which is now MongoDB. So I sat next door to the early MongoDB team. However, the CDN was not using MongoDB, which was, in hindsight, it seems strange. They were in MySQL, they had this one database with a couple of replicas, and basically everybody owned it and nobody owned it. Because my first assignment with that job was to go do some fixes in Django Python code that was responsible for both the UI and the billing code, mm-hmm. very quickly that devolved into, you know, figure out performance issues, and that quickly turned into the database as a problem. So I sort of tripped on it very early on. For a long time, my title was basically junior software engineer or software engineer. But in reality, in practice, I was doing at least half of my time doing databasey things for that task.
How long did you stay in New York until you went over to SendGrid? Were you still in New York?
Basically, yeah. So a year after I started with Panther Express, that was the name of the company, it got acquired by CE Networks. I stayed with that for three more years. So I worked and lived in the Northeast for 4.5 years. And around late 2011, there was reorgs in CG Networks, and a lot of us engineers at US stateside were let go. And I was looking to go back to California because that's where my family has still been, even after I had moved to the Northeast and, you know, ran into SendGrid.
Sure. Well, you know what? Here in the Northeast, we miss brilliant people like you. New York City's got a ton of them, but we do miss great talent like yourself.
Thank you. I still have a number of friends from that old job up in the Northeast. I catch them whenever I can in conferences. I have a soft spot for New York. Since I left, I didn't go back to New York until the IPO of SendGrid. And I came to town with like, here are the things I want to do. I had a full list of like pizzas and bagels and, you know, food cars to visit. It was like a whole nostalgia tour for me.
JJ Asgar, who works over at IBM, he got in touch with me earlier today, and he's like, "Coming to New York, I need a pizza list." And I was like,
"Right,
you know, I get it." You know, so as a local emissary of food, I always make sure when people come to the area, I'm like, "All right, you should eat here, have this falafel. Not from there, go to this stand." So you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just I'm a New Yorker. I know how to help people get around. So you do DBA stuff at SendGrid, and then eventually SendGrid gets acquired by Twilio, and you go from just the DBA to a principal engineer, which is where you're at now.
I actually became a principal engineer. I became a principal engineer before the acquisition.
Okay.
I got the senior part, you know, shortly after the acquisition. We're still obviously like it has been less than a full year since this acquisition closed. So integration is still an ongoing thing. I no longer report into SendGrid specifically, but I still spend a lot of my time helping that business unit continue the successful work it's doing. But also, you know, starting to get familiar with the rest of Twilio, trying to find, you know, spots where I can offer value basically.
Very cool. So That leads me to talk. Which one of these jobs would you say was the first one you started like as an on-call resource?
I started getting on call back at Panther Express. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it at the time, but because Panther's team was so small, they actually had all of the engineers, including the development engineers, on call for the whole stack. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, because it was my first job out of college, I didn't realize that this was not a thing, that the more normal thing was that you have a specific ops team that's on call and the sure. engineers just throw the code. So I consider myself lucky that I managed to start off on the right foot there, where I could see everybody actually owning the stuff. And as part of that team, I became on call from that first job.
Kind of. So early DevOps/SRE before it was actually codified into a thing, I suppose.
Didn't have a name yet, but you know, they were already doing it just out of necessity. The ops team was two dudes, and that the CTO back there was like, that's not tenable. We can't have only two people on call. So that was very useful for me to learn early on. So I was on call with them, and that's why I also back in that job, even though my actual day tickets were like Python, Django, you know, the databasey things, I still got my hands a little bit in the rest of the stack of the CDN, which was, I believe, mostly Java. So
I guess keeps you on your toes as far as actually doing development work, but then, you know, keep you nimble with the database. And have you been mostly just working with MySQL databases your career?
Most of my specific data store experience, like hands-on experience, has been MySQL, although more recently I've started to read more and get, I learn a lot through incident analyses. both inside Twilio and SendGrid, and just things that are shared out in the wild. These are the ways I usually, I don't know what kind of mentality there is, but reading how the things fail is usually how I figure out how to use them. So that has been very useful. And I found the early on-call experience with the full stack was also useful, because being on call for just a specific part can put you in a bubble. Mm-hmm. And it was very helpful for me to understand like the full impact of changes from, sure, you know, edge applications and pops across, you know, APAC, for example, all the way to the database server that's in
New York. And you start to realize why certain organizations that work in enterprise put in ITIL type of rules, because changes can be so impactful and they can go over so many places. You can get the idea why when you, the bigger the place, the more controls there are for change, I've noticed.
The overhead of communicating across a large number of humans. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. And there's pluses and minuses. You know, it's interesting to hear it. When I went to like DevOps Enterprise Summit, to hear about how so much is process. Whereas a lot of companies nowadays, it's all about pipeline, build the pipeline to get it to production. So it's interesting to hear different places in different ways where they all want the same thing. It's just right. It's all about velocity, I suppose. And, you know, I guess more controls, it's all dependent on how big you are.
Indeed.
So let's go a little bit into the blood and guts of the show, if you will. The part where I really, really love asking you to kind of take a bit of control. And before you do that, I need to talk about the rules of the podcast. And there are only three, because I don't like rules that much. I grew up listening to punk rock. I try to stay away from rules. But nowadays, I have three. One, do not incriminate yourself. So I don't want you to get in any trouble. Do not incriminate others, because all of our retrospectives are blameless. And three, help us learn, because this is a retrospective. Why don't you tell me an interesting, whether it's an incident or a series of incidents that really you learned something from?
So I actually, like you and I had prepared for this, and you had told me to think of a story, and I struggled for the last few days to actually think of one. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer on call, which is a very strange thing to say now. Mm-hmm. This is a more recent development, but I had been on call for well over 10 years across the few companies I've worked at so far. And so many, 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 many incidents. So it was hard to actually pick one. One of the recurring themes, both for my on-call and as I watched, as I hired a team and watched them be on-call for the same stuff I had built and, you know, go through some struggles as well. It's always a surprise, the growth that you have to encounter. There's always going to be themes as the company's traffic and customer base and, you know, MRR, all those metrics mm-hmm. start growing by orders of magnitude. And so that was definitely an important one to realize, like if the thing that you don't think is going to break, and as you're building the new features, don't build for the current volume that you have, look at your growth and, you know, plan for at least 3 years, or you're never going to be able to go back and fix things because too much is going to be on fire all the time.
Sure. So did you run into many situations where capacity planning really wasn't ideal and you ended up getting kind of, I guess, thrown into it?
Yeah. One of the things I did learn over the years is if the thing breaking by the time it's in production and someone is on call, then it's kind of a bit of a late in the game kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that can go in building things in the process of how to build a thing in advance that can go a long way to make the on-call experience far less damaging to the humans who are on call. Mm-hmm. This probably applies more for when a company starts going through this like off ramp of like a hockey stick kind of growth.
Sure.
Less so when they're early on and they don't even know if the product they're building is going to have traction. So, you know, with that caveat in mind, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I guess you get to the point where reliability become so important. And reliability in both modern applications comes in a number of different services that you have to apply it to.
Right. When you're very early on, like seed stage angel investors, it's probably plausible that you're just trying to find your market fit. Mm-hmm. But once you start going into, you know, six figures of monthly revenue, things like that, by the time your customers demand reliability, you know you already have a problem usually.
Yeah, and I've noticed that data-based capacity planning is one of the more difficult things in IT. Like, I spent some years at Mongo, and when I was there, you know, the one thing people always had the hardest time doing is estimating, you know, how many physical servers they were going to need, or if they were virtualizing, how many systems they were going to need, and they never got it right. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. In almost my entire career, I've never seen anybody capacity plan around databases right. Early on, I noticed, you know, people just not planning or trying to do master-master in MySQL way too early before that kind of technology was ever. People just tried too much with too little. Mm-hmm. And then they found out at the wrong time that it was too little. And so I feel like we're in a better place than we ever were around capacity planning, but there's always room for mistakes.
Yes, I mean, one of the big mistakes that I've seen too many companies go into early on is you set yourself up for multi-tenant single cluster, which always makes later on figuring out what are the low-hanging fruits, how are your workloads have actually gotten distinct, harder mm-hmm. to do. So some thought in advance of like, maybe not put everything in one table, maybe not put everything in one schema. Yes, early on, it's probably too much overhead. It's overkill to be like sharding your databases. Like, say, don't shard early on. I get that there's overhead to things. But have that in the back of your mind, as at some point we want to be able to do that. And what is the metric that we're going to track to tell us it's time to do that?
Sure. And what cost are we going to pay? Are we going to pay the financial cost now by paying too much, by sharding it? You know, that's the thing. If you're a startup, you have to be realistic about your infrastructure implications about doing a sharded database. Yeah, you're going to add a little bit more redundancy and reliability. You'll get better performance. I understand that. But maybe you don't have that much runway to have those extra six replicas or whatever.
Right. And to be fair, like some of these things are easier now for the early stages than they used to be. We didn't have something like Aurora where you didn't have to worry about the disk space of your hosts. Mm-hmm. So that's nice. But nothing is without trade-offs. Aurora can get really, really expensive when you start hitting it with a lot of requests. Things like Dynamo can start having hot shards as your traffic grows. So I have this interesting conversation with like younger engineers all the time now, where it's like, well, yeah, but like you don't have to worry about this. Like, you put it in the cloud and it will scale. And I'm like, nothing goes forever. And maybe it does scale, but maybe does it scale fast enough for what you're doing even? Catch up with your peaks?
Mm-hmm. Or what happens when the auditor calls and says, well, you know, we need this kind of compliance and we need to move into this kind of database infrastructure, and it's completely different than what you have now. You got to be able to be ready to change or to deal when things break, I think, is another good one too.
Yeah. Another pitfall that I have learned across like multiple outages, sort of like in pieces, has been just the general mindset of the architecture. It is too easy to build a stack early on that fulfills the customer needs, but in a very synchronous manner, where now you've got things like a database with a single writer as, you know, part of how you're fulfilling the customer's task. Down the line, that might not become favorable. You might realize that, okay, the single writer goes down. Back when we had 10 customers and that server went down, we could accept, you know, a 20-minute downtime. Now that's no longer acceptable. Sure. So your constraints of when you build, the constraints you've had when you build the thing can change over time, and you got to be prepared that you you never find yourself through what we call in my architecture team, like one-way doors, where it's like, you built it a certain way because of the constraints of the time. Cool. But was it a one-way door? Or can you find your way out when the constraints change?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. With as a service is taking on the way most people run databases now, do you think that there's a certain lost art to database monitoring that we've got now? Like, I think that not everybody understands the importance for a long time that came with monitoring around database infrastructure and the actual database itself. Do you think that there's been something lost in not understanding enough of what's going on under the hood?
Yes, the struggle tends to always be being able to correlate, you know, metrics that you get out of a database host up to like business impact. Mm-hmm. And that can mean wildly varying things depending on how you're using the database. For example, if it's a reporting server and you're seeing latency of certain queries go vary between like 30 seconds to 5 minutes, with the context of it being a reporting server, that might be okay. But if that variation is happening on like your primary database where the writes that are happening, it might be a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. If even worse, you're doing most of your writes synchronously and your application is actually waiting on the return, that's an even bigger problem. And you start finding yourself very quickly having to deal with trade-offs like, can we introduce an asynchronous layer between the application and the database so that we just throw it over in a Kafka queue and then wait for a response to come back? Is that plausible? How does that impact the user experience? And you find yourself thinking through all these things. That's why I go back to, as a company grows, they're going to have to grapple with, how do we build stuff? How do we actually solve the business problem? Because you either ask these questions when you're figuring out how to build the feature, or you ask these questions in the number of postmortems you will have later because the feature broke so many times.
So let me ask you, with changes in what people monitor for now, like when you're on call lately, would you say that, and you're not on call now, but in the last few years when you were on call around databases, would you say most incidents were around performance, or were they around, metric-based alerts? Like, were they, I guess, when I say performance, like, was it something from the application you noticed, or right, were they metric-based? They're both very, very different, if you know what I mean. Something more,
yes, like nothing patient with the database, but everybody's coming in complaining that, you know, feature X is slow.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be a thing. So I'm not on call anymore, but I do actually still go to a lot of postmortems across the org, because I still find those very interesting. I would say, yeah, like tends to be 80-20. There's always the for lack of a better word, the simpler incidents where a host was rebooted, or like a specific thing happened and we have 500s and it's like clear cut kind of what happened. And at that point, you know, the retrospective or the analysis is about learning how to limit the blast radius of such failures. So that's one kind of class of incidents. The ones that are definitely more insidious are, you know, query X is now taking, you know, 10 times longer than it did a year ago. And these are actually harder to, you know, get people to even sit down and retrospect, because technically it wasn't an incident. There was never a delineation of like incident reported and incident resolved. It's just like sort of a slow burn kind of thing.
Where people notice thing over time, but don't necessarily report it until it's got to the point where they're like, now it's a problem. You know, it's a common theme I've noticed in technologies that people are afraid to mention things until they consider them a problem. Even if it's obvious and it's in front of them. I just think it's got to be with just, I don't know, hesitation to create more work for people. And I think sometimes we don't communicate. You're telling us these things because it will reduce work for us long term. Tell us about the problem beforehand, you know. And I found that, especially around databases, it's one of those things that I would want to hear, because maybe you notice a little hiccup, but you think, oh, it'll work eventually the right way. Maybe we missed an index. You know what I mean? Maybe there's something that we didn't do in a migration. And so I think there's a good need for the conscientious developer, as Andrew Clay Schaefer likes to put it, to also make mention when they notice performance differences to the people that work around databases and operations. You got to tell us soon.
Right. I think when you mentioned this, the first thing that comes to my mind is Wostrom's model of psychological safety in work environments, which shout out to Nicole, to Dr. Forsgren for putting it in her book. If anybody is listening has not read Accelerate, you should absolutely read that. It's an excellent book, and all the Dover reports too. But yeah, this is basically the crux of it, is what kind of work environment is in place realistically, and are people allowed to point out issues, or is there, you know, political or, you know, environment impediments to being honest about these kinds of things? Because it's going to break anyway. It's part of growth. Like, people can look at it as you're pointing out a problem, or you can look at it as this is a learning experience. Let's all figure it out together.
That's why postmortems are so cool.
Yes. Well, I mean, if done right.
It can be very cool if done right. Yes, absolutely. Yes. This is the better way to put it. So let me move you along a little bit and wanted to just ask you one question I'd like to ask people who spent time on call. If you could give some advice to someone that's listening to you, who's on call, what would you tell them is the best for them, or the best advice you'd give them?
I would say, if you are on call in an environment and you don't have, before anything happens, a clear path to ask for help, run away. This is a high demand environment. Like, as far as like tech in general, there's a lot more jobs than people who are skilled. It's not acceptable anymore to have on call path, like situations where it's like a single person and that's the only person ever on call for this thing, and they can't ask anybody for help. That's a red flag.
Reduce your own personal bus factor.
Yes. It's super important, especially for those who are on call, to learn how to have boundaries. The boundaries, like while on call, like, does that mean like, if there was a tough night, take the next day, something like that. And obviously this, I am saying this in the abstract manner, and sometimes people don't have that environment and it doesn't actually encourage that, but that needs to be an honest conversation. On-call can be, I've personally struggled with burnout in the past. I have spent a few years being the only DBA, but very early, very quickly we were like, no, that's not tenable. We hired a full consultancy outfit that were my on-call backup for like years. And, you know, that kind of organizational support is super important. So if you're not getting it, you should demand it.
Very, very cool info. So is there anything that you're working on lately that you want people to know about, or any talks you have coming up?
I kind of ended up taking most of this year, all of this year actually, off from conference speaking. I did a few talks in 2018 and it was a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work. For me personally, travel is not an easy thing logistically to do. I have, you know, 3 children, 2 of them are still toddlers. And if anybody falls on Twitter, they'll hear me sometimes, you know, tell stories about what the twins have done recently. I've sort of not been going to conferences as much this year. Maybe next year I'll start getting into it again. Other than that, yeah, like you can see probably like the occasional blog post from me on my blog. And mostly otherwise, heads down, you know, working with William.
That's really cool. Let me ask you a question before I kind of let you go, because you brought up, you know, you have 3 kids. And so I've had another mom who spent some time on call, Pumala Schmidt, and she talked a lot about, you know, how being on call can be greatly impacting on your family life. Can you say that you've seen either – time impacted on your family from OnCall, or did you be able to, like, were you able to mitigate that?
It's funny, like, so I was on call throughout having all three of the kids.
Wow.
Although with the twins, it was slightly less impactful. At that point, I was already hiring a team to help out. Like, I was no longer the solo DBA in the company. We still had actually the consultants as well. So my team was very, very supportive. Like, they didn't escalate to me unless absolutely necessary. But I do remember with my first kid, like, I distinctly still have vivid memories of, like, on the one hand, the kid is, like, sleeping or breastfeeding, and the other hand, I'm, like, single-handedly, like, typing on the keyboard to get a database to come back to life. It was definitely a struggle sometimes. I'm hoping that we're starting to get a little bit better right now, as, like, understanding that not everybody in tech is a specific demographic, and that sometimes we have kids and it's women, and it's like they carry the higher responsibility of childcare. There's still a lot that could be done. I will say though, like, OnCall definitely prepared me for having the kids though. Like, waking up in the middle of the night, well, I was already doing that anyway. So there was that.
That's funny. You know, I always can appreciate one thing that we all can have, like, a common thread around OnCall. We've all been woken up at odd hours for odd things if we've mm-hmm. been on call in technology for a long time. You know, like yourself, I was about 10 years straight between a few jobs. Not with children, but I always can respect the people that, you know, build families while trying to keep things sustainable, both at home and online. So it's something mm-hmm. that I give a lot of respect to, especially, you know, you've got a whole other thing with a growing family. You know, three kids, that's a ton of work. And you add on your database work on that. You know, I really wanted to say, you know, thank you for sharing a lot of the things you do online. It's always interesting. And people can find you where on Twitter?
DB Smasher. You will, these days, a lot of my tweets are about how I just break technology. Like, literally everything I use. And this is not just work. Like, the latest thing yesterday was basically making my iPad unable to tell sideways, like, portrait from landscape. I'm finding the funniest part is my new coworkers, like the leadership team in Twilio proper, now that we're getting to know each other, and they're just, like, completely freaked out by, like, the things I can make the technology do. So that's the current fun. I'm glad people are finding it funny. It's mostly a venting mechanism for me.
I know what that's like. That's a little bit of my own personal Twitter. So anyway, thank you very much for being on today. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up, everyone. Sylvia, it was great. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jake.
Okay, we'll be right back with me wrapping up OnCall Nightmares.
Well, thank you, Sylvia, so much for that interview. I really appreciate it. If you want to reach out to Sylvia, it's pretty easy. Just go to Twitter. Go to @DBSmasher. Talk to her. She's really funny. She's really interesting. And I think you're going to learn something. So if you want to be on, you know how. Just send me an email, oncallnightmares@gmail.com. I want to talk to more people about their life, their scenarios, their stories, how OnCall has impacted them. Until then, I'll catch you next time when I speak to another technologist about their time on call.